This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with Dave Itzkoff. He's a culture reporter for the New York Times, and his book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Remember 1976, the year that brought us Rocky? Well, it also brought us Network, with a riveting performance on the big screen from Peter Finch as Howard Beale, a movie that is still talked about all these years later and now is presented in all its glorious detail, The Making of Network with Dave Itzkoff. Also, C.B. Forgotston, the Capitol Watcher, with a look at the upcoming legislative session, which starts a week from Monday. Will it be a session to remember, or will it be a yawner? We'll talk about it with Capitol Watcher C.B. Forgotston. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside this area. 877-217-5757. InksterShow@WRKF.org if you'd like to reach us online. Our guest is Dave Itzkoff, culture reporter for the New York Times. He writes regularly about film, television, theater, music, and popular culture. He's previously worked at Spin, Maxim, and Details, and his work has appeared in GQ, Vanity Fair, Wired, and other publications. He's the author of two previous books, Cocaine Son and Lads. He lives in New York City, where he joins us today, and we're talking about his latest work, which is getting all kinds of attention, Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Good morning, Dave Itzkoff.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, good to hear your voice. This movie, Network, which is now listed on practically every list of the 100 greatest American films of all time, when it was made, it was like watching legislation being made. It was not a pretty sight, but what a group of characters.
That's right. I mean, if people remember it for anything, it's the speech, you know, given at the heart of the movie by a television news anchor who is, you know, essentially lost his mind at that point, you know, imploring his viewers to go to the window and open it and stick their heads out and yell, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore." And that became a very potent slogan for the year 1976 when it came out. But it's also an idea that has endured, and not only this idea of American frustration and what the movie got right about that, but even how it really predicted exactly what was going to happen to our media and what was going to happen to news, that we don't really have these kind of dispassionate television anchors anymore. We have people who are, you know, speaking to a viewer's emotion and, you know, really trying to get them to connect to their own anger.
Before we get to the remarkable cast and what was depicted on the big screen, you start with the screenwriter, an amazing man who had won two Oscars, and this, I think, is no doubt his signature work.
That's right. I mean, to tell the story of Network, I mean, you are essentially telling the story of Paddy Chayefsky, who is a New York screenwriter who passed away in 1981. You know, in the 50s, he was really known for his work in what was the golden age of television. He wrote Marty, which became the Academy Award-winning film in 1955 with Ernest Borgnine, and in 1971, he wrote a social satire called The Hospital, which also won an Academy Award for him. But by 1976, when he's writing Network, for all the professional success that he has had, he's also had a lot of frustration in his work and in what he feels is his lack of control over it. And he's also just a very sort of perceptive guy, very, some would say, paranoid about, you know, all the different fears and problems that he sees coming to America, everything from, you know, inflation and, you know, depression to, you know, trouble in the Middle East to just a kind of sense that people are becoming alienated from each other. And he feels that he somehow has to tackle all of these ideas in a single screenplay, and that becomes Network.
And Network's director, another Hollywood luminary with a lot of ups and downs in the business, and this one was perhaps his greatest work, Sidney Lumet.
Absolutely. I mean, he also, you know, had started with Chayefsky in the golden age of TV, did a lot of live television directing, and makes his breakthrough doing the film version of 12 Angry Men. And, you know, by the 70s, he's evolved this kind of naturalistic directing style. He directs a lot of sort of gritty New York stories, the movies like Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. And Network is in some ways a kind of quintessential New York tale. It's about a very oppressive city that's going awry. But Network, in a way, calls more upon his talent and background as a TV director. And there are lots of sequences that are set in a live television setting that, that, you know, he proves to be just the right person to capture on film.
And perhaps, hard to believe, an unlikely choice for the lead role in this film, a guy who was considered to be washed up, Peter Finch. Tell us about how he was chosen to be Howard Beale.
Well, I mean, he was almost chosen by default in the sense that, you know, the creators of the film really wanted to cast the Beale role first if they could, and they reached out to some of the most, you know, prominent actors of their day. You know, they wrote to Patty Chayefsky writes to Paul Newman saying, you know, you can have any role you want, but I really hope you'll play Howard Beale, and that unfortunately doesn't get very far. They also try to cast George C. Scott, who had starred in The Hospital, but he'll only do it if his wife can play the female lead, which is not really a route they were willing to consider. And, you know, Chayefsky's own lists included actors like Walter Matthau and Jimmy Stewart. And, you know, really none of these people, you know, even if they respected the screenplay, they had some sense that it was going to be really incendiary and controversial and didn't really want to touch it. Peter Finch at that point was living in a sort of semi-retirement in Jamaica and, you know, flies in from New York for what's not even so much as an audition as just a little conversation with Chayefsky and his producer. And, you know, once they see that he can do a kind of passable American accent, they're satisfied, and they want to get the cameras rolling.
He was in failing health, as we found out, but he obviously had some vigor left, and it was a great performance on screen. But when he got this role, he'd been around the block many times, and even by even by Hollywood standards, Dave, he was considered to be a bit of a rogue.
That's quite right. I mean, he you know, he had done a lot of work in Britain, both on the stage and in film there, and, you know, was a member of a great sort of fraternity of carousers there. I mean, actors like Oliver Reed and Peter O'Toole and Errol Flynn, they certainly got around in their evenings. But, you know, at a certain point, you know, he did get clean and did sort of, you know, lay off of all that. But by the time he makes Network, you know, he's pushing 60. And, you know, certainly, you know, shooting scenes like The Big Man at His Hell speech took quite a lot out of him. And, in fact, you know, he was given a lot of responsibility in promoting the movie when it came out. That's in, you know, November of 1976. And then just before the Oscars, he dies in the midst of promoting the movie in January of 1977 and becomes ultimately the first actor ever to win an Academy Award posthumously.
Well, when he filmed the scene that is most synonymous with Network, the "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore" scene, how many takes?
This is one of the great, great stories. That scene, they only were able to get 1.5 takes of him performing that speech in its entirety. You know, Lumet, to his credit, knew that it was going to be a very challenging scene. So they shot it once. He had a second camera, already loaded up with film, ready to go for an immediate second take, which Finch then began to perform. And he got maybe about halfway through, about a minute and a half in, and then told the director that, you know, he just couldn't do anymore. He just didn't have the energy. And Lumet allowed that. Lumet was the kind of director who liked to work quickly and was very confident. If he saw a performance in front of his own eyes that he was satisfied with, he had the faith that it had somehow been captured on camera. But again, here you have one of the most iconic performances in cinema, and they only have one complete version and then maybe about half of it for backup if it didn't work the first time.
He's the crazed anchorman, Howard Beale, and here's how it sounded on the big screen about 37 years ago in Network with Peter Finch.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
That's Peter Finch. What a remarkable performance, and what a cast that joined him in Network. Actually, my favorite performance in that film comes from William Holden, who was at the end of his life as well. He only had
a few years left.
Right, exactly.
To that point, I mean, Holden, you know, has already had this illustrious career in films like Sunset Boulevard and Stalag 17. And you know, he's in his late 50s. He no longer sort of looks like the marquee idol that people remember him as. And there's actually a lot of dismissive attitudes towards him in Hollywood, in the industry, and they're looking for an actor who has a kind of that has some miles on him, somebody who can play a kind of disaffected news director who, you know, has been there and seen it all. And if it weren't for, let's say, you know, the fact that Peter Finch passed away while they were promoting the film, and I mean, Holden himself was an Academy Award nominee for this film, you could make a credible case that he could have easily won that award, too, if Finch had lived on.
And Faye Dunaway, as you write, brought her tantalizing and intimidating exterior, curious intellect, boundless passion, and mercurial mood to the part of Diana Christensen.
That's right. She was a challenge for this film, as she often was to other directors that she worked with. To this point, you know, she had made movies like Bonnie and Clyde, and Chinatown, and certainly we know in Chinatown she clashed quite a bit with the director Roman Polanski. And, you know, on Network, on the one hand, you know, she very eagerly embraces this role that she knows is going to be controversial, playing a very, smart and savvy female executive in an all-male working environment. And, you know, she knows, especially in 1906, that that's a part that is gonna spur a lot of discussion, and maybe people won't love the character, but she's still happy to play it. But she's a person with a lot of ideas about how a role should be performed. She fully expects that her director is going to listen to her input and entertain her ideas. And there's also a very central love scene in the movie that is going to involve, you know, a little bit of nudity. And she almost pulled out of that scene on the day that it was supposed to be shot and could have thrown the whole movie into jeopardy if she had done it.
The movie, when it came out, did not get great reviews from a lot of prominent reviewers. For example, the New York Times, your newspaper, there were some cruel words about Network. I think, what was it, Frank Rich, if he was writing for the Times then, I don't know, but he said it's a mess.
Right. Well, in fairness, Frank Rich was writing for another newspaper at the time when he wrote that, but it's true what you say that, you know, there were a lot of people, not only in the sort of field of professional criticism, that were bothered by the film, but the television news industry itself completely disowned it. And, you know, just almost to a person, you had people like, you know, Walter Cronkite and John Chancellor going on the record to tell the world how bad they thought the film was. In some cases, people who hadn't even seen the movie yet but just knew of its reputation, were so dismayed that it could somehow portray TV news in a negative or satirical light. These people really had no sense of humor about themselves, but also thought of their business as kind of sacrosanct, and it just offended them that anybody could see a sort of dark underside to the work that they did.
The book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies, from Dave Itzkoff, about the film that a few years ago was ranked 64th among the top 100 greatest American films of all time, chosen by the American Film Institute, starring Peter Finch, William Holden, and Faye Dunaway. Faye Dunaway has perhaps the second greatest line in that film. When Peter Finch is going into his rant, she tells William Holden, "They're screaming in Baton Rouge." We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A bit more time with Dave Itzkoff of the New York Times. His book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Dick Cavett says Dave has blessed us with a vivid and richly entertaining account of what goes on inside the making of a hit movie. The mixture of intrigue, creativity, infighting, and astonishing behavior of the famous and the driven, all of which somehow came together to produce a superb motion picture, not to be missed. Now, the movie came out the same year as Rocky, and the network did win 4 Academy Awards, but did not get Best Film that year. Although there was one contest, Dave, in which Rocky and Network tied. There's quite a story to be told about that.
That's right. That in in these sort of preliminary awards that are given out before the Oscars, these kinds of awards that are in more regional, there was a Los Angeles award that was given out prior to the Oscars, where Rocky and Network tied for best film, and one of the producers of Rocky was sitting right next to Paddy Chayefsky, the screenwriter of Network, when the tie was announced. And so this producer, extends his hand in congratulations to Chayefsky. Says, congratulations to you. And Chayefsky's answer is, "I hope you die."
And he might have meant it.
I think he probably did. I don't know how thrilled he was to be sharing any honors at all with Rocky.
Rocky's a Rocky's a pretty good film, and it is a iconic figure for totally different reasons, with Sylvester Stallone running up the steps in Philadelphia. But this film, I think, has more legs. My guess is that they'll be talking about Network a century from now.
I think so. I mean, I think it really speaks to, two different states of mind that the country was in 1976. I think there was a part of our psyche that was still trying to process the post-Watergate years and was still, feeling, very much, like we hadn't quite come out of the Vietnam era. That's, I think, what Network was speaking to. Rocky is more of the sort of, the uplifting spirit of the underdog kind of movie. And that's what the Academy essentially rewarded for Best Picture. But I tend to agree with you. I think I feel like Network certainly speaks more to my state of mind and the way that I view the world. And I certainly hope that that lasts.
Well, the movie Network was made for $3.8 million or thereabouts, and it grossed $24 million. Modest by today's standards, but at that time, that was a big hit.
Sure. Well, you also have to remember that, movies did not open on, 3,000 screens all at once in their first weekend the way that they do now, that they, they played in, some local markets first. Usually, a movie like this would open in, say, New York and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., and if they got good responses there, it would start to move around. But, certainly, making, more than $20 million on a $4 million budget, multiply that by a factor of 10 for, today, if you had a $40 million movie making, over $200 million, not only with the stars that this movie had, but also really with the kind of sentiment that it had, that this is not a sort of, happy-go-lucky, uplifting film. It's trying to tell you some very some really dark lessons, not easy to digest. For a movie like that to be as wildly received as it was, I think is really kind of remarkable.
Rachel writes to Inkster Show at WRKF.org, noting that both Peter Finch and William Holden were not that old, you say late 50s, and yet looks so old on the big screen, that they both had full lives. And she asks about Finch's last public appearance. Was it on The Tonight Show?
That is exactly exactly right. Literally the night before Peter Finch passed away, he was the lead guest on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. Carson, you know, really loved Network, and you know, you can see Carson's enthusiasm as he's talking to Finch and reciting the lines from the movie, playing clips. The great irony is that one of the next guests after Peter Finch is the stand-up comedian George Carlin, and Carlin comes out and does a routine that's entirely about death and, you know, his theories about death and what he thinks happens after you die, and he even makes a joke, kind of wistful remark about how death is like a movie and that, you know, when you die, you get to see the movie of your life, and at the end of the movie, you see your death and you see yourself watching the movie of your life. So in a sense, when you die, you're, as long as the movie goes on, it never really ends. And, you know, hours later, after watching this routine, you know, Peter Finch is in the lobby of the Beverly Hills Hotel where he has a heart attack and dies.
January 14th, 1977,
right.
The 20th anniversary of the death of Humphrey DeForest Bogart.
Wow.
And it was a spectacular performance, and his widow ends up taking the honor at the Oscars.
That's right. And another really sort of fantastic tale there is that, you know, Peter Finch, who had been living in semi-retirement in Jamaica, there he meets a woman and has a child with her and later marries her. And a lot of the country does not know that he has a wife who is black. And for the Academy in 1976, 1977, it is a very uncomfortable matter for them to have a black woman accepting an award on behalf of a white man. And so the network producers and Patty Chayefsky have to resort to a kind of subterfuge to get her up on stage. They say that if Finch's name is called, then Chayefsky will go up and accept the award, which is what he does. But then when he gets to the podium, he invites the widow to come out of the audience and pick up the trophy. And it's a really indelible television moment.
And Finch, that was one of the things that was whispered about him, was his personal life, not only the wife he married, but he had other relationships, including one with the remarkable singer Shirley Bassey.
That's right. I mean, he was, even by the time he met the woman who, you know, would be his widow, I mean, he was twice divorced, and yes, I mean, you know, this reputation, you know, incredible as it can, as it seems in the year 2014. I mean, someone who was really sort of, you know, looked down upon, or he almost had to kind of, you know, keep it in the background that, you know, he had, you know, lovers and a wife, you know, who were not, did not have the same color of skin that he did.
Well, he was an amazing actor, as was William Holden, perhaps an even greater actor, and he was a man who was a big screen legend. And for him to essentially give this film to Peter Finch, it took some gumption from Mr. Holden.
I agree, and if you go back and you watch the scene of the Oscars and, you know, the announcement of the actor who's going to be, you know, the winner of the Best Actor Award. And, you know, both Holden and Finch, are, of course, are up for that same honor. And, you know, Holden is there at the ceremony, and there's a camera pointed at him as Finch's name is called. And you can see him almost, you know, breathe this kind of sigh of relief that, you know, I'm sure there's a part of Holden that, you know, really felt that he deserved the honor, too. But I think once Finch has died, I mean, really, who else could the trophy go to? If Holden had won instead, or someone else had won, I'm sure that would have been, you know, a tremendously awkward moment. I think he must have been, in some ways, you know, gladdened that Finch did get this kind of final posthumous honor.
A tale of two talented and tormented men played out on the big screen in Network, in their prime, late in life. Very late in their lives, William Holden and Peter Finch, and it's all detailed in Dave Itzkoff's remarkable book, Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Before we leave, Dave, who's your favorite to get Best Picture Sunday night?
Well, in terms of, you mean who do I like best or who do I think
Well,
is
both,
take
both.
It? Well, I'm fairly certain that it's going to go to 12 Years a Slave, which I thought was really, I mean, a spectacularly made movie and tells a story that I think everybody, you know, needs to see, certainly. In terms of, you know, a movie that really kind of spoke to me personally, I have a lot of affection for American Hustle, which is really set in the New York City that I knew and grew up in. But if we're just playing the numbers here, I have a pretty strong feeling that 12 Years a Slave will prevail.
We're going to go to CB for Godston in just a moment, and we've got a few folks who would like to talk with Dave. I'm sorry we won't be able to get to each of you, but let's try Philip in Ponchatoula. Philip, you're on the air with Dave Itzkoff of the New York Times and author of Mad as Hell.
Jim, you've expressed how you appreciate William Holden as an actor, and so do I. And it's really tragic and sad the way he died. And I wondered if your guests could go into that a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah, he died.
Yeah, no, I'd be glad to discuss that. I mean, certainly for everyone that was involved in Network, some of them, died within, just a couple of years of the film coming out, including Paddy Chayefsky. Holden himself, we talked about Peter Finch's wilder years, and Holden also had his share of carousing. And as far as, everyone in the industry knew, he was now, clean and sober. But, in fact, he had this sort of apartment for himself that he kept in Los Angeles that he would sort of sneak off to and have these kind of private benders. And, very unfortunately, he goes to this apartment one day and, has some drinks and, passes out, falls down, hits his head and, bleeds out very rapidly and dies.
And like Peter Finch, who died, as you say, in the lobby of the Beverly Hills Hotel, life imitating art, William Holden, of course, had that death scene in Sunset Boulevard in 1950,
right.
And 31 years later, he died in the same way, tragically.
Yeah, more or less, exactly. And it's very... It's very eerie when cinema can have that kind of predictive power. I think certainly our screen idols come under a little more scrutiny than the rest of us, and I think it certainly magnifies these kinds of deaths, and it just kind of it just sears it on our consciousness when we learn about these things.
Well, congratulations on a fantastic book, Mad as Hell, from Dave Itzkoff. Thank you, Dave.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the time today.
Let's talk soon. I'd like that.
That would be my thrill. Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're joined now by the Capital Watcher, C.B. for Godston. C.B., are you mad as hell?
Usually.
And not going to take this anymore?
No, but I have to keep taking it, it seems like. Nothing changes.
Well, I prefaced your appearance by saying, is the session going to be volatile, or will this be a yawner?
It depends on what one's interest is in the legislature, whether it's going to be a yawner. For the media and the average citizen, I think it's going to be a yawner because of the fact that it seems like Bobby Jindal has no specific agenda, which means the focus will be on the state budget, which is exciting to me but doesn't excite many other people because, I think that's a serious problem. And hopefully there will be an opportunity for the media to focus on the budget, whether they like it or not. And we're going to find out, some very revealing things if the legislators ask the right questions.
We had Jay Darden on this show yesterday, and the lieutenant governor said the governor has his eye on something else. And today, Bob Mann's column I'm reading that will appear in the Sunday Times-Picayune says, as the nation's governors left the White House last Monday, Connecticut Governor Malloy was furious. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, he muttered, was a cheap shot artist. Mm-hmm. And later, he called Jindal insane. So, yep. What do you think?
Well, there's no doubt that Bobby Jindal has his mind on something other than running the state. and it's on his presidential ambitions. So I don't think that makes for a very interesting session, for the average citizen. Bobby Jindal's always good at getting headlines, but he's not so much at accomplishing anything. And I don't know what his goals are other than to ingratiate himself to the public, whoever that he can, you know, attract the attention of by either blasting the president or whatever. And it's attention grabbing, but it accomplishes nothing for the people of the state of Louisiana, as far as I'm concerned. And I think Bobby Jindal would be better off if he focused on more local issues like the budget and things, which he has no interest in, because that doesn't get you national headlines. And he's through as far as what his role is going to be in Louisiana, and he's leaving it to the rest of us to pick up the pieces while he's off doing other things.
Well, some polls have shown that President Obama, with all his flaws that are perceived by the electorate in Louisiana, is more popular in this state right now than Governor Jindal is. Do you believe that?
Yeah, I believe it, because I think Bobby Jindal is extremely unpopular, which makes one wonder why he would not be back home more trying to ingratiate himself with the public of Louisiana, so that he would have a base on which to run for national office. But he just doesn't see it that way. Bobby Jindal does his own thing, and, you know, whatever happens, happens. But as long as he's happy, he doesn't care about anything else. And I think he's somewhat delusional in that standpoint, and the people that are suffering from it are those of us that must live in Louisiana or that do live in Louisiana.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757 for CB for Godston. Now, even in the best of times, governors in their second terms are lame ducks, and this is the seventh year. I think CB for Godston has called it, or not CB, but Bernie Pinsonat called it a seven-year itch. Well, is it? Will the seven-year itch produce a three-ring circus? I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of issues that are peripheral to the needs and that are most important in the state that will be discussed a great deal. For example, whether or not we're going to bring back the electric chair. That's one that's bound to get a lot of attention, CB.
Well, it will, and that's the kind of stories that the media likes to focus on, because it's strictly emotional. It's not complicated. You don't have to figure out numbers or anything. And it will be, at best, a distraction in the legislature, and there will, you know, that's the kind of thing that the media likes, and that's what it'll focus on. In the meantime, the important things like what are we going to do about our tax code and the budget and all that will just float along under the radar, and that's, you know, that's in Bobby's best interest, because he can take a strong stand on bringing back the electric chair.
Medical marijuana, that's another one that's going to get a lot of attention, and some people believe that's a real serious issue, but it's the kind of thing that is irresistible for talk shows and other entities.
Oh, it's already taken up more time than things like the budget and, you know, the future of the state and things like that. Those unfortunately, are what I guess the people want to read and listen to and watch in the media, and it gets people emotional. People like to talk about things they're emotional about, and you know, so there will be a lot of what I call sideshows.
297-5633. We'll continue our serious discussion with CB for Godson in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing, and our guest is CB for Godston for a while longer, 297-5633, Inkster's show at WRKF.org. Leonard Joseph writes, hello, Jim. It's one thing for the governor to be unpopular with the people, but when will the people realize they elected him twice? The governor did win two races by large margins. What do you think, CB?
Well, I think the people are recognizing it, and they're having buyer's remorse. But there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, yes, we have the recall option, but that we know that that's not practical when you have to get a third of the registered voters in the state to sign a recall petition to do it. So that just isn't going to happen. So, yeah, there's a lot of remorse out there. And, you know, I'm surprised that it hasn't manifested itself more. I think, I think his 35% approval rating in the polls is kind of high. I certainly don't have the access to the public like you do, but I don't hear many people calling in to defend him on these radio shows and writing letters and things like that. Maybe you get more of it than I do, but I just don't see it. I used to when you would get on the show or anywhere in public and attack a governor or something like that, and I don't consider myself attacking him. I consider myself just telling him my point of view and what I think he's not doing. Usually it's just a pile of people calling in to question that, and I don't see that. So I'm wondering where the 35% is.
Well, that number is 35-40% is probably accurate, and the governor knows it. It's been revealed he spent a lot of money in last year on polling by his firm On Message, which includes Timmy Teeple, his former chief of staff. And perhaps as a result of that, CB, he has reversed course. He's, for the first time in his tenure, he has increased funding for higher education. When I say increased, it's nowhere close to the level it was in 2008, but for the first time there is a little bit of an uptick here. Does it matter?
No, because it's not enough to make any significant difference. But what he's doing is he's pandering to public opinion. So he can say, well, I increased funding, because he's tired of hearing all of us talk about how he's reduced funding for 6 years for higher education. And he's doing other things. The question that never gets asked of him is, where did you get the money? Because we don't have significant revenues. We do have additional state revenues coming in, but they're not nearly in the amount that he is using to pander to certain groups in the state to try to increase his popularity. And in fact, when you look at where he, when you finally dig in, which the House Appropriations Committee chairman refuses to do, the staff doesn't seem to be doing it. There's nobody out there really digging into this. You find out that what he's doing is draining funds, for instance, for the Medicaid eligible for nursing homes. He's taken that fund from $800 million, and it will be basically zero once this upcoming fiscal year's budget is completed. He's taken the last $220 million out of that. And that he's leaving it for the next governor to figure out, what are you going to do about these poor people who are in nursing homes? Are you just going to kick them out? Or are you going to raise taxes, or what you're going to do? So, for every good thing that he seems to be doing, if we were properly exploring it and asking the question, Jim likes me say, well, I'm going to give $100,000 to LSU this year. And you say, well, that's great, CB. Where are you getting it from? And I'm going to say, well, Jim, I'm going to borrow it from you.
All right. Well, one thing the governor accomplished was the sale of that downtown office building. The Baton Rouge Area Foundation purchased it for $10.25 million. But, CB, I think, if I remember right, going back a few weeks now, you note that apparently that's been in the budget not once but twice, the sale of that building. Is that right?
That's correct. It was in the fiscal year 13 budget, and it wasn't accomplished, so we had mid-year budget cuts. It's in the current year's budget, so all that means is that particular hole won't exist, but that doesn't mean there aren't mid-year budget cuts, because we've already had two colleges announce mid-year budget cuts within weeks after the Commissioner of Administration, Christy Nichols, announced there wouldn't be any mid-year budget cuts. So, the things are, when you borrow from Peter to pay Paul, you don't accomplish anything. And that's what Bobby Jindal has been doing.
Hold that thought for a moment. Now, in the business world, you just can't do something like that. The IRS would be all over you if you had something on your balance sheet that involved the same thing twice in 2 years, and there's only one payment. So basically, we've got a 10 and $250,000 building that's been in the budget twice now for $20,250,000.
Well, that wouldn't be an IRS problem necessarily because
well, if it affected your bottom line, it would be in the taxes you pay. Sure,
but I think the board of directors would fire the CEO. He was trying to balance the budget with the same money twice, or they should balance. They should fire the CEO.
All right, Wade at Louis on the line for CB. Good morning, Wade. You're on.
Hey, Jim, CB. I appreciate you.
Hey, Wade.
Call. Hey, it just sounds from what you're saying that Bobby Jindal's doing pretty much everything that a good conservative money manager would never do. But what are the chances of the legislature and the governor actually raising revenues in order to fund all these critical education and social programs that are just absolutely in dire need of more revenues?
Well, he's going to raise revenues this year for the colleges, but as you well know, can't raise taxes during this regular session. And I don't think he will raise taxes as long as he's governor. The next regular session in 2015 is they can raise taxes. Of course, they could do it in a special session. But Bobby Jindal, by continuing to borrow money from various funds and just leaving IOUs and not putting any of the money back, I think he's leaving it for the next governor to raise taxes. And I've heard State Treasurer John Kennedy speculate that it was be like a billion-dollar hole when the next governor comes in. I've been looking at numbers and make it look more like $2 billion because of things like the $800 million hole in the Medicaid for nursing homes. So
quite often, CB, governors do inherit budget problems because it's easy to pass it along to the next guy. But if I remember right, Governor Jindal was one of the few Louisiana governors who actually inherited a surplus, didn't he?
You're absolutely correct. He and Dave Treen both. And both of them acted just like Republican governors do. They spend more money than any Democratic governor. Bobby Jindal and this whole fiscal problem we're facing right now can be traced back to the $1.1 billion surplus that Governor Blanco left Bobby Jindal. The first fiscal thing that Bobby Jindal did when he came into office in 2008 was to raise the spending cap by $1.1 billion, and it's been downhill ever since. And that, you know, is basically a surplus, which is one-time money, and he quickly rolled it into the operating budget, which means we got to come up with that money every year. So, I for Bobby Jindal to claim to be a fiscal conservative would just be a total fraud.
Well, he will run for president, and of course, CB was not a fan of Governor Jindal when other people were voting for him in large margins, but we look forward to getting your input. I don't know of anybody who follows the process as closely as you do, and what was it that Tom Aswell said about you recently?
I'm not sure. What was that?
Well, I don't know. I think he said you were the a watchdog of significance.
That's indeed a compliment, and I appreciate it because I consider Tom quite a watchdog and much more articulate than me.
Well,
I wish everybody would pay more attention, and then we wouldn't have repeats of Bobby Jindal. We would have had a one-term governor.
Well, I've got an email here from a listener that's much too long to read, but I think there's a point to be made for Governor Jindal and economic development. Hasn't he done a pretty good job on that front, CB?
That remains to be seen because I don't believe the numbers they're being put out. I think they're miscounting the numbers. In fact, there was an article in the Baton Rouge paper this morning, I'm sure you saw it, that the state supposedly is giving away billions of dollars in tax breaks for businesses. We're basically buying businesses to come here. And that's not a true economic development. If you were looking at this as a fiscal conservative, and look, I don't disagree that we aren't buying businesses. Bobby Jindal has brought it to a new level where it's just, we used to just give tax breaks. Now he just offers cash. I mean, he spent down a $600 or $800 million fund in the Department of Economic Development.
Well, but sometimes you got to spend money to make money.
Well, yes and no, but you got to look at whether the benefit outweighs the expenditure, and there's been no accountability by the Department of Economic Development. All we get is an announcement at the ribbon cutting that they're going to create 22 jobs today and 1,000 10 years down the road, and we never hear about whether those 1,000 or 10,000 happened.
Well, we look forward to talking with you often, and
sure.
It's good to get CB's take on the world. And as I stated, he follows it closer than anybody I know. CB Forgotston at Forgotston.com. Thank you, CB.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Again.
Bye-bye. 297-5633. We switch gears a bit as we close out the hour with Rolf Larson. He's been helping organizations develop entrepreneurial strategies to increase mission impact. He's the author of Venture Forth, the award-winning guide to social enterprise, endorsed by the late Paul Newman. And Rolf Larson is in our community. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Tell us about the challenges that are out there for businesses, and particularly the kinds of businesses that you work with.
Well, let me give you some context for social enterprise. As you may know, I'm sure you do, nonprofits like WRKF exist because the private sector, which provides wealth for some and jobs for many of us, leaves some people behind, especially our most vulnerable populations. Nonprofits also address social issues such as environmental protection or health care. Social enterprises blend the two sectors, for-profit and nonprofit, by using the marketplace to address those social issues. They sell products and services to pursue their mission, not to maximize profits. Now, you ask about challenges, and certainly that's a challenging world because they operate within the marketplace. They face the same challenges of finding customers and providing quality products and delivering good service. At the same time, their goal is to oftentimes serve vulnerable populations like at-risk youth or people who are suffering challenges of former incarceration or past behaviors. And so it's a challenge operating, but there are good examples both locally in the state and nationally for doing that.
Well, as I stated, you are in our midst, and what are some of the ideas that you wish to convey in your stay here in Baton Rouge?
Well, we're doing a workshop in a couple of weeks there, and March 18th and 19th. And the logic of that is to, this two-day really intensive but fun workshop is to help people think through and do the steps of creating a social enterprise like I was describing, for one that will fit their organization. Typically there'll be nonprofit organizations or sometimes sort of mission-focused for-profit companies or consultants use these techniques as well. And the strategy then is to figure out what fits for your organization, pretty much like any business would. What are our strengths, our core competencies, people say? What does the marketplace look like? And what could we do that would accomplish our mission goals, which may be to serve groups of people or address environmental issues, at the same time succeed as a business so we can pay our bills like any other business? So it's understanding the marketplace, understanding what you're good at, looking at your competition, and then developing a plan, a business plan, or a small business plan, in the case of this workshop, to move forward with your idea.
The guest in our remaining time is Rolf Larson. His book is Venture Forth. How is the environment out there for business, both in the for-profit and nonprofit sector right now?
Well, I can speak mostly in terms of social enterprise business, which are typically nonprofits, sometimes for-profits. I mean, I would say, you know, they operate within a lot larger business environment, and so, you know, both the opportunities and challenges for growth and for risk occur out there. It's particularly a good opportunity for nonprofits because nonprofits bring to the business world oftentimes a long history of knowledge of the key players in the community, understanding of the relationships between people, and so there's a natural progression from working with the community to providing services to that community or to other nonprofit organizations. So, for example, I just learned yesterday there's a new social enterprise in Baton Rouge called the Triumph Kitchen, which is profiled in the local paper, The Advocate, and they're providing training to at-risk youth providing culinary, hospitality, and life skills to at-risk youth. And so that's a great example where they're sort of taking that idea and, you know, people got to eat.
And it's March 18th and 19th. We'll find out much more about social enterprise from a man who specializes in this and has written a book about it, Venture Forth. How can folks register for the workshop, Rolf?
It's very straightforward. The organization is called the Grantsmanship Center. They just go to the website at tgci.com. They happen to be a for-profit with a nonprofit mission, the Grantsmanship Center, so tgci.com, and they can register directly that way. Do you want a phone number, too, or is that sufficient?
Certainly. Go ahead.
It's 800-421-9512.
It's 800-421-9512, and it's tgci.com. Rolf, we look forward to your visit in Baton Rouge, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who heard you today who will be there in a few weeks. Thank you, sir.
Great. Thank you, Jim. Bye now.
And until Monday, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.